Hi, my name is Bo Johnson. I'm here again in the margins, and I'm here with Latoya Watkins, or Dr. Latoya Watkins, let me be clear, who won the 2015 Pushcart Prize. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Latoya.
As Mr. Johnson said, I am Dr. Latoya Watkins. I teach creative writing here at UTD, and I also teach literature at Collin College. I am working on a novel and trying to get a short story collection published.
All right, that's great. So the story that you won the Pushcart for, and so for those who don't know, the Pushcart is a collection of the best stories from small presses throughout the country. And so the story that you won the Pushcart for was called The Mother. And one of the things I sort of think is interesting about The Mother, and there are many, many things that are interesting about The Mother, but one thing is the sort of construction of the Black family, or sort of this construction for the Black family for other people, for sort of people who are outside of that idea or that mediation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Black family, I kind of researched this in my dissertation, which I defended in April of 2015. I researched the Black family during migratory periods in America. And what I found was that because of the condition of the Black family in colonial America, slavery, antebellum South, it's very different. There are a lot of different kinds of Black families. And the story, The Mother, the Black family consists of a mother and her son, and she really didn't raise her son. She was a prostitute, and she wanted to protect him from that life. So before he's taken into foster care, she tells him that he is God, and that kind of sticks with him throughout his life. He goes on to become God for himself and a band of followers. And I thought that that was... I wanted to have him come from a single parent home at some point. He didn't always live in a single parent home. His mother married one of her Johns, but he never kind of received him as a son. I wanted him to come from Hawk, to come from a single parent home, because there is so much this talk about dysfunction in that type of home, it doesn't always come from the idea that there's just a single mother. It can come from things that are within the community that surround the family. And what happens with Hawk and his mother, it occurs because she wants him to see her as something else. Other than a single mother, something like the mother of God. So it comes from ambitions. This kind of dysfunction within their family comes from these ambitions placed on them from outside of the community.
So it's interesting. There's a couple of different things I want to ask you about in terms of that. So in one instance, we have, and I think this is a kind of atypical, I put sort of air quotes around typical way of thinking about the Black family as this sort of single mother and then children after that. And then there's this also this weird disconnect that exists between, so like you have a single mother and then you have a son. And sort of like the relationships that then exist between sort of Black men and Black women are often, at least from a sort of mediated perspective outside of the Black family, thought of as a kind of contentious relationship. And we see this sort of historically with like the Monahan Report, right? Where Patrick Monahan basically says, like, you know, the destruction of the Black family is because the woman is too powerful. And I kind of sort of see these sort of like strands in your story. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I'm having a hard time kind of not referring to another story that I wrote that kind of, I wrote it after reading the Monahan report, and it deals with a male who is the father of two children, and he lives with the mother of those two children. She lives in public housing, and what happens is he is unable to be the man of this house, the patriarch in a sense, but it's not just on her.
Mm-hmm.
The dominant society that she lives within, the government, the housing authority, dictate his participation,
absolutely,
his what he does. Once a year, he has to fill up a trash bag with his clothes and mm-hmm. hide them in the car because her house is inspected and mm-hmm. no man is supposed to live there. The government, in order to kind of offer this aid, this medical assistance, food, assistance with food, require that a man not be there in this, in the environment with the children or the mother. So it places the power in her hands. She gets the benefits, the food stamps and the Medicare. He recalls going into taking one of the kids to the doctor's office and trying to use the medical card and how he's made to feel by the nurses and the administrative staff at the clinic. And it's less than a man. But of course, he takes that back to Teniola, the woman he's with. Mm-hmm. He blames her for this. Mm-hmm. These are things that she has impressed upon him. Of course, he has a hard time finding a job. He's not educated. But these things, I'm not saying that he's blameless in the whole thing, but it's not her either.
Yeah.
She hasn't, there's no way for her to, these things aren't, they're, neither of them are powerful mm-hmm. at all in any sense of the word, but within the community or within this family structure, she's the one who kind of holds the keys because she holds the keys to the house. She holds, you know, the food stamp card and Medicaid and whatever else it is that the family has access to. But that does not give her any power at all because she still has to keep him at bay when she really wants to be with him. She mm-hmm. really wants to be a woman in this relationship, but she can't.
So it's interesting because I think then we, so you're coming at this from a very literary perspective, but there is also clearly sort of these attachments to the larger society.
Yes.
Like, one of the things that we can talk about, we can talk about this endlessly, frankly, is the ways in which various Black communities around the country have been formed by these kinds of relationships, where so you have the Monahan Report that sort of blames again mm-hmm. sort of like Black degradation or whatever it is that he's, whatever the terms that he's using on the Black woman, is sort of ignoring the fact that the government was highly responsible for creating these systems in the first place, particularly sort of like kicking the Black man out of the family. So, and we could talk about this again in terms of poverty or drugs or mass incarceration mm-hmm. or any number of systems. But what I'm interested in and actually referring to is sort of, again, so like how this then functions for you from a literary perspective. How do you then sort of take the world that you see and the sort of very real problems that exist and then turn it into fiction? So what's that process like for you?
Those stories aren't just, they're just not out there in fiction. So say Pruitt-Igoe, you've heard of Pruitt-Igoe.
Yes, of course.
Before Cabrini Green, mm-hmm. all of these stories, you have documentaries
yeah.
on these places and spaces and how they discuss the Black family within mm-hmm. them, but you don't necessarily have those ideas taken and placed in to fiction or anything that has to do with literature. And then if you narrow that, or if you like come in on that, even take it out of the big city and put it in, you know, these smaller towns or places like Texas, small farm towns or college towns in Texas, then you don't see it at all. So you have these stories that aren't told. And as a graduate student, you're always running into this type of stuff on your own in your research because it's definitely
so
not given to you.
So
and you don't know what to do with it outside of writing a research paper on it. These are things that kind of keep me awake at night. So what I do is I like to create stories. I will never forget in one of the classes here at UTD, we were to write a paper on it's Carissa Terranova's class, we were to write a paper on something, and I chose this, it was a Soylent Green class, and I chose this Pruitt-Igoe idea from a documentary. I don't remember if she brought it or if I watched it on my own because I was doing research. But there was a young lady who talked about her dad being forced to leave if the family wanted housing. And the family had like 8 children in it. Mm-hmm. So the mom and dad sat down and they talked about it. And he decided to leave, went somewhere, started another family. They didn't hear from him much because he had to leave the state, not just the city. He had to leave the state in order for his family to get housing and food. And this was during the 60s. This was in a time when Black people were really struggling in this country. So they needed this. And that was a sacrifice they made. He didn't do it because he didn't love his family. He did it because he loved his family. And that struck me as, you know, something sad and beautiful at the same time. And I wanted to write it. And I took that woman's face and kept it in my head and created a character from her. And I think that's as simple as my process gets. There are all these stories, especially Black stories, that are untold, because it's easy to get a story published if it's something that's appealing to the dominant culture. But people don't like to read about this type of systematic racism and oppression, but it's still important to write about it.
So let's talk about that for a second, because it is important to talk about it as well. That you said that you want to sort of talk about these stories and write these stories and create these stories from this perspective of people who've been impacted by systematic oppression and institutional racism, right? So what's the struggle getting those kinds of stories published?
Oh my gosh. It's, I think I submitted stories for 5 years before I was able to get a story published. I thought, this is just not for me. And I would hear in workshops that this is too gritty, this is too raw.
Gritty and raw, what that means.
this is not, nobody wants to sit and read this and be depressed after they finished.
But they'll read Hemingway.
Right. People want to feel a certain way while they're reading. And after they've read, they want to be rewarded for reading. But I think that just keeping at it, there have been times when I have thought, okay, maybe this is too depressing. Maybe I do need to write what is considered a happy story. Mm-hmm. But I've never been able to complete that story. I like writing stories that are realistic to my research, my society, and my culture. I think that I don't know anyone who looks like me who hasn't felt some type of oppression or some type of difference in the way that they've been approached or treated at some point ever. So I think it's important to write in those spaces, no matter how it makes a person feel.
So when you, I guess I should sort of qualify this, insofar as you've broken through, because obviously there's still like barriers, right? Because it's not like these things go away magically one day. Like you write a story, it's published, you win an award for it. That doesn't make, oh, everything is wonderful now. I can just sort of relax. So in speaking about that, what are sort of like, how do you get through it? Because I think a lot of people of color, but Black people in particular, it becomes not easy, but it becomes draining to continue on when you're faced with so much conflict and you're always being looked at differently or spoken about differently, or people degrade your work simply because they say, like, well, I got that, you got that because you were the Black person, right? So how do you continue to go forward?
I love writing. It's therapeutic for me. It's a way to release. Everything that I bring in from the world each day, and I don't think that I could survive without it. That's one part of the process. But when I finished a story last week, it's called Black Gal. And I just know the title is not going to be read because it's the title.
Yeah.
But I've already submitted it to 15 journals. Just because when I first write a story, that's when I have the most confidence in it. I think to just continue to write for the writing, continuing to write because I love writing, and then submitting because I feel that those works are important and those voices need to be heard, is what keeps me pushing through it. But then also knowing that in 3 months there will be 15 rejections mm-hmm. sitting in my inbox is something that's always there. But if there are 14 and someone likes it, that's just a surprise to me. That's just, you know, I guess the gift. I always consider it a gift that someone has actually read the work and been moved by it and given it the time. Because a lot of them won't when they read the first line or when they read the title. And I realize that. I realize that a lot of people won't read it. And I think as long as I remember that, I'll keep kind of submitting.
All right. I think that's actually the perfect note to end on. I want to thank again Dr. LaToya Watkins, and I am Poe Johnson at Within the Margins. Thank you and goodbye.